This is Fresh Air. I'm Barbara Bogave, sitting in for Terry Gross. Dorothy Allison's best-selling first novel, Bastard Out of Carolina, told the story of an abused child growing up in South Carolina in the 60s. It was based on her own life story. Now, in her new book, Cave Dweller, Allison explores the aftermath of domestic abuse in a Southern family in this decade. Dorothy Allison has written explicitly about her life, her childhood abuse, and her lesbian sexuality in both her essays and poetry. She's now raising a son with her partner, Alex. In her new novel, Cave Dweller, the main character Delia is a recovering alcoholic who fled her native town of Cairo, Georgia, to avoid almost certain death at the hands of her violent husband. She left behind two small daughters. After a marriage and a career as a singer for a rock band in L.A., Delia returns to Cairo a decade later to recover her lost children and redeem her past. She brings with her daughter Sissy from her second marriage. Here's Dorothy Allison reading from the beginning of her novel, Cave Dweller.
Emptying the closets of the little cottage, Delia picked at the raw sore of her conscience. It had been 10 years. Her girls, Dee Dee and Amanda, they were not babies. They were 11, 13, nearly grown. What if they didn't hate her? What if her girls hoped for her as much as she hoped for them? From what if she fell to maybe, then to might be, could be, oh God, surely so. It was the way she thought when she was drinking, as detached from the real as anything could be. It was the voice in the back brain, the voice that swore one drink wouldn't kill her and another was all right, too. The devil or desperation, that voice, whispered steadily, drew her on. Delia swore she would never drink again, but her girls were not liquor. Her girls were real. Cairo was real. Cairo was home. Maybe no one could earn forgiveness. But listening to that whisper, Delia Bird packed everything she owned and decided to try.
Dorothy Allison, welcome back to Fresh Air.
Well, thank you.
I find it interesting that right in the beginning of your book, you set up this situation for Delia, that when you've fallen so low or so far in your life, there's almost no way to distinguish hope from self-delusion. Is that how you saw the book beginning?
That's not only how I saw the book, it's how I see my life. Yes. I wanted her at rock bottom, up against the wall, had to decide to change her life. And I think that that opening just pushes her over, triggers everything that follows.
Now, eventually, this whole family ends up living together. Delia, her daughter Sissy from her second marriage, and her two daughters from her first marriage. And they live with her first husband, who is dying of cancer and who has made a pact to help Delia get her daughters back if Delia helps him die. This is all really enormously complicated. What interested you about bringing these women together under these fractured circumstances?
Well, what I wanted to write was a novel about forgiveness, a novel about repentance and how do you make amends, which is very, I know lots of people do that, but I have seen people forgive each other. I wasn't sure that I believed it ever really happens. I wasn't sure I believed in forgiveness. So I had to, in order to figure it out, I had to write it out. And I wanted it to see if Delia could be forgiven, because I think she has committed an unforgivable sin in abandoning her daughters. And I wanted to see if her husband Clint could be forgiven, because I think his sin is unforgivable as well. I don't think they forgive each other, but I think that in the course of trying to work through this, they earn a kind of redemption for the children and for themselves.
I really like in the beginning of the book when Delia takes off for her hometown of Cairo, Georgia, with her daughter to recover her two daughters from her first marriage. She ends up in a diner right inside Cairo, and a waitress is waiting on them. The waitress is real sweet. There's a real Southern hospitality thing going on. But then the cook leans out of the kitchen and says she recognizes Delia. She says, yeah. I know you. You should do it. You have the accent down. What did she say?
Well, Delia, of course, immediately assumes that she recognizes her from Mud Dog, which is how she became famous, as this kind of second-rank blues and rock and roll singer. But the cook recognizes her as that woman that ran off and left her babies and, you know, calls her name in the middle of the diner. Everybody looks up. It's that kind of public crucifixion that we all hope we never have to endure. And she does it in front of the youngest child, Sissy.
The cook says, "You're the one who ran off that with that rock band, and don't think we don't remember. You're the kind."
Yeah, we remember you. You're the kind we remember.
So cold. Now, have you seen this happen, a fallen woman return home?
I've seen fallen women not only return home, I've seen them triumph. My mother gave birth to an illegitimate child at the age of 15 and simply had to walk through Greenville County for the rest of her life with everyone knowing what she had done and stand up under it at a time when that was a large weight to carry. That was the unforgivable sin, was to have a child out of wedlock. Late 40s, early 50s, impossible. And she did it. She did it with a great deal of grace, but with enormous damage. The kind of muscle that it takes to be despised and not despise yourself. That's what I was looking for in the women in Cairo.
And you were the daughter who heard the whispers following your mother?
Oh, yes.
Like what?
I remember being 7, 8 years old and putting up a lemonade stand and having the little girl next door come tell me, "Nobody's going to buy you a lemonade because you're a bastard." Going in to tell my mother that and watching her face because there was nothing she could do.
What did she tell you to say or do or think?
She said, "I'll buy you lemonade." Bought the whole jar and brought me in. She told me never to be ashamed of myself. She told me that people will have all kinds of opinions about who you are and what you do. She said, "You just stand up. Don't let them back you down." And that's pretty much what I watched her do.
Now, how did you understand, or how do you understand now, people like the cook who don't, I suppose, reconcile these contradictions? This person was hating Delia for leaving a man who was basically about to kill her and leaving her children. Despising a woman for saving herself, but they also hate the men who are violent to the women. I mean, it's such a contradiction, but those two things exist at the same time in mm-hmm. people who condemn women like this.
It's kind of interesting that we can forgive men. We find it really difficult to forgive women in that situation. The woman who runs, especially a woman who runs and leaves her children behind, is just, that's unforgivable. And I think that's the trick of it. None of us ever really believes it was as bad as Delia knows it was. If you were living in Delia's head, you would understand why she ran. But everybody else, looking at it from the outside, thinks she should have thought, she should have made a plan, she should have been more rational, or she shouldn't have married him in the first place. I don't think we really understand violent relationships in any complex way. And we hold the women responsible, even though at this point in time we have so much more information. We still, a mother, that kind of, supposed to be the paragon of virtue, supposed to hang in there. And the one who runs, nah, we don't really understand.
When Delia goes home, she repents. She has this, what you call, season of repentance. And there's a very touching moment when she comes home. She's been attending a Baptist church for a while. She's completely destroyed. But at one of these services, an old lady touches her. She uses Delia's shoulder to push up out of the pew. And this is taken by everyone as a sign of or a promise of forgiveness. Is that mm-hmm. something that would have been noticed by everyone in a church and in a small town like Cairo, that one of their own had touched a sinner?
Oh, yes. Oh, yes. They're watching them all. That you can't imagine what it's like to be the sinner in a small town, to wear that public cloak. They watch you every minute, every minute. And the woman who touches her is a woman of virtue, one of the older women in the church. And she touches her purely because it is so evident that Delia has suffered so completely. They never forgive her when she runs off and she's with the rock band and she's living the good life. But the woman who has come home and is destroyed and is publicly suffering, that woman they can imagine taking back in, partly because she makes such a great parable. They can show her to their daughters and say, look, that one, she was doing good, but look how God has brought her down. Yeah, they love her.
It's a walking Bible story.
Yes. The trick, of course, is that Delia is a strong-willed woman. She would never have asked for their forgiveness. She couldn't make herself do it. All she really does is fall completely apart, and the women friends in her life take care of her, and they drag her to church every Sunday, show her suffering, because they know that's the only way for her to win a place back in that town. Delia herself, if she was herself, wouldn't be able to stand it.
My guest is novelist and poet Dorothy Allison. Her novel, Bastard Out of Carolina, was a bestseller. It was also nominated for the National Book Award. Her other books include Trash, a collection of stories, and a book of poems called The Women Who Hate Me. Her new novel is Cave Dweller. We're going to talk more after the break. This is Fresh Air. If you're just joining us, I'm speaking with Dorothy Allison. Her new novel is Cave Dweller. A beauty salon figures pretty prominently in this book, Cave Dweller. Delia takes over the lease on the beauty shop. I really like how you write about this shop, how hair salons in these small towns, probably really anywhere, are, as you put it, all about dreams and lust and the approximation of a fantasy that, you know, doing up your hair like a movie star for the prom or Saturday night. Is a really big deal and probably the only time that women feel safe in these towns being sexual, talking about sex.
Oh, true, it's safe country. Well, you're there to be reconstructed. You're there to be put in the hands of other women who are going to make you the best you can be and send you out into the world with all that hope. It is a dream. It is a fantasy.
You know this beauty shop scene firsthand?
Oh, Lord, yes. Oh, Lord, yes. Well, my mother, when I was a girl, my mother earned money by doing women's hair in her home. She wasn't a beautician. She was a waitress, but she was really good at it. So women would come to her to have their hair done. And my sisters inherited her talent. One of my sisters worked for a long time as a beautician, and I would go to watch her.
Now, did women really talk about sex when they were getting their hair done?
Oh, of course. Uh-huh. It was women's country. It's like men had clubs, women had beauty parlors. And you think about it. You're laying back. Your head's all greasy and warm. Somebody's had her hands on your face. You're like laying in your mama's arms. You talk about anything. And any woman past adolescence is going to discuss that subject they're not allowed to discuss on the street.
Now, what were you taught about sex growing up?
That it was dangerous. That it was woman's responsibility. That you could never trust any man anyway, but never mind.
Now, you've written, of course, a lot about your family and your books. Your stepfather physically and sexually abused you. Did you have a religious rationale as a child for the abuse, given the contradictions of what people did and didn't say about sex?
No, I didn't. I used to think God wasn't looking. That's the only way it could possibly work. God wasn't paying attention to us. And I got fairly angry about it. I used to try to imagine what it would take to get God to look at us, give justice to us.
Did that mean in your mind that you weren't worth it to God to look at you?
Exactly, exactly. And I don't know any answer. I'm sure that no one intends that whole sections of the population, especially young girls, believe themselves beneath the glance of God, but that's exactly what it feels like. It feels like there is sanity, there is law, there is justice, but it's for other people.
Now, if you didn't have a religious rationale for it, what rationale did you have in your head?
Oh, man. Uh-huh. It's unfortunate that one of the given myths of the working class is that men can't help themselves. Men are dogs. Women are responsible. And it's the same ethic that makes it impossible for women to really have full use of their own lives, because the whole job of a woman is to somehow contain, corral, and mystique a man into being better than he intends. I don't believe it now, but it is pretty much what I was told as a girl. I think a lot of girls were told it in the 50s, 60s, early 70s. I think it's one of the things the women's movement changed, which was simply a demand that men take responsibility for their full lives, not leave it in the hands of the woman who's going to have to fight them off.
Now, your mother wasn't able to protect you in this situation. maybe you've settled this in your heart, why she did what she did long ago. But in writing this book about a battered woman trying to redeem her past and her relationship with her children, were you putting yourself back in your mother's place again? Did you come to a different understanding of what she did and who she was?
I think just because of the changes in my life, I had come to a different understanding. There's no answer to the tragedy of my mother's life. My mother spent her entire life trying to be a good Baptist woman, to save her husband, to redeem him, and believing that that was her job, her lot in life. She did everything she could to protect and care for her girls, and she believed herself to have failed, and in many ways she did. In other ways, more basic than I can ever explain, she didn't. She literally saved our lives over and over again. There's no justice in what was demanded of her. I don't know anyone who could have lived that contradiction and answered it. If you're not given the option of leaving, which she didn't have, she couldn't, she was a good Baptist woman, she couldn't leave him, then you compromise every day of your life and eventually you destroy yourself. I wanted to write a book about a woman who leaves, who leaves badly, who leaves broken, who fails, and then through sheer stubborn will and with the invaluable support of the other women in her life, her women friends, goes back, saves her children, retakes her own life. She does it at enormous cost, but I know women do it.
Have you forgiven, in any sense, your stepfather?
Forgiveness is a large concept. I have tried to understand, and I'll tell you the truth, I think I have failed. I think some of the reason I have created the men characters that I have written is an attempt to understand. But I don't, I genuinely don't understand a man who is violent with children, a man who would break the heart and soul of the woman he loves. I've never quite gotten to that place of understanding. I have tried not to do myself any damage. And I decided long a time ago that thinking too much, pushing too much at this knot does me a damage. So I don't keep him in my mind. I don't wish evil on him. I've put him in another place. That's as close to forgiveness as I can get. I think sometimes we talk a little bit too easily about forgiveness. I'll tell you the truth. One of the reasons I wrote the book I have written is to show how long and complicated it is to forgive someone, how much work it takes, both to forgive and to earn forgiveness.
Is it something you see yourself still working on in regards to him?
I try not to think too much about my stepfather. There are dark nights when I do. And like I said, I don't understand him. I have no way to touch his heart. And I'll tell you the truth, I don't want him to touch mine. There's too much pain there. No, I've made myself a place of safety. It's a lot easier to write fiction than it is to change your own life.
Now, you said that this book, Cave Dweller, was a way of proving or working out for yourself whether forgiveness can actually happen.
Yes.
Where do you get to at the end? Where did you get to at the end of writing it?
I got to the where I began to believe that not only could forgiveness actually happen, but that you could learn to trust love. One of the things that is common to all of Delia's girls is that none of them trust anybody. They don't trust themselves, and they do not trust love itself. And a lot of it is because they watched their mother with Clint, and they saw the damage that was done there. This happens a whole lot more than we talk about, that young girls grow up believing that there's this myth of love, but there is no reality, and that you have to go armored into the world. I began to believe, after I worked my girls up, you could love, that there could genuinely be people you can trust with your heart.
Now, in all of your writing, your public persona and your private life have merged so often. It's interesting to me how you would decide what to keep for yourself.
You know, I've never thought of having a public persona. I don't separate off that way. I'm a child of the 60s and early 70s, and we were all trying to live our one life and not be different at home or in the world. Didn't want to have that mind-body split or separate up. So I've never thought that there was anything in my life I could wall off. And actually, I learned very early on that because of a lot of the circumstances that I've grown up in, I couldn't afford to be ashamed. I couldn't afford to start hiding things about myself. So I've had to be very matter-of-fact and blunt about subjects that lots of people don't even want to hear about. Sometimes I don't want to talk about. But I don't dare start playing into that place where fear lives. I don't start hiding. But I know that particularly the last few years, I've made a pact with my sisters not to talk about their children. I try not to talk too much about my son. It's going to be hard enough for him in the world. I'm trying to imagine that there are places where I don't need to drag everybody. It gets a little complicated.
Dorothy Allison, I want to thank you so much for talking today.
Thank you.
Dorothy Allison's new novel is Cave Dweller. This is Fresh Air.